It's Tuesday, September 11th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 276 of Through the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Beth.
This is Wayne.
And I'm Adam.
And for anyone who's not clear on who Adam is, because we've had another Adam on this show recently, this is an Adam who has been referenced a lot on Fear the Boot, particularly in the past year or two.
Urban myth.
But has never actually been on the mics. This is my sister's husband, or my brother-in-law, Adam. So I'd like to welcome Adam for the first time in the flesh to the show. Adam plays in my Star Trek game.
Yay.
Adam, you kind of have an interesting story in general, at least from my perspective, because I realize it's kind of weak-minded to limit anyone to a simple social stereotype or archetype, but when I met you, you struck me more as kind of the man's man jock type, just because you were in the family, right? You started listening to the show to see what your brother-in-law was doing, and suddenly took an interest in gaming. And I'm curious, what triggered that crossover?
Well, the manly man thing was a total front in the first place.
Wasn't it your charming voice, Dan?
That's what it was. The first time I heard...
The manly man thing is a front, except for the fact that you've been wanting a canoe, you were working on keeping your eldest son ambidextrous so he'd be the best pitcher possible. You do all of your...
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You do all of your home upgrades and renovations.
Well, I don't want to claim to be manly because that's a high calling these days. But no, I think I've always liked this kind of nerdy stuff. Can I just say nerdy stuff?
Sure.
I've always liked nerdy stuff.
We give you absolution.
Nerdy is cool now, right?
Sure.
So maybe I've just been slow to the party.
You're just young enough for the geek chic thing. Because you, how old are you?
30.
Oh, you're 30 now. Okay. Yeah. So you are
kind of babies.
you are kind of on the cusp, though, of like John's generation or the geek chic. The stuff that got us books knocked out of our hands and stuffed in lockers was kind of cool by the time you came through school. Sort of. Maybe not exactly, but.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what was cool where I grew up because there was 20 people in your class, so your exposure is very limited.
So whatever you liked, at least 5% of the population
was into.
That sounds like a dream.
Yeah. If you can talk your buddy into it, all of a sudden it's a fad.
It's 10%.
That's awesome.
All right. Quick reminder that we still have that contest going on that's running across shows, the postcards from the Dungeon 1. If you don't know what we're talking about, I will link to the full rules in the show notes, but the gist of it is, you want to send us a postcard from the dungeon written in character, and based on the winners, which are selected by the various shows in our little affiliate network, we will come up with an ultimate winner, and anyone who makes it to the final round will win a free game, and the person who makes it to the absolute final slot will get a whole bunch of games. So,
considering how many creative people we have in the community, this is probably the contest I've been most excited to see the results on.
I can't wait to read these.
Same here.
These are going to be great.
And it shouldn't cost you too much to enter, because what is a postcard stamp now?
Oh, who knows?
I think 35 cents or something like that.
I was going to say 32.
I was just going to guess $4 the way the post office is going. But
is there a cover art element to this too? Is it just the back of the postcard where you get the message?
No, they can tie it into the front if they want. You know, if you can find a postcard that has like a Space Hulk on the front and you want to write on the back,
or
about
if you're artistic, you could draw your own picture.
Yeah, you could draw your own postcard as long as it's roughly 4x6 normal postcard size. You know,
every time I hear the term Space Hulk, all I can think of is big green Incredible Hulk floating through space,
the torn pants and a space helmet.
Just kind of spinning.
Angry, can't do anything about it.
Yeah, he smashes, but then he just, you know, momentum takes him back.
Yeah.
The vacuum makes him angry. Okay.
That's okay,
I guess, Wayne, not coming from comics, but coming from games, every time I think Space Hulk, I think large abandoned spaceship overrun by gene stealers with...
Wait, and the first time I heard about that game, I really thought someone was talking about playing a game about Incredible Hulk on a spaceship.
Wayne, I was right there with you. I had no idea that that was a ship. I was thinking, why is the Incredible Hulk in space? Did I miss a memo?
At least I'm not alone.
Okay,
I'm not sure what difference it makes, whether he's in space or on
Earth.
He
has to wear a hat.
I see. With a chin strap if he's in space, because it'll just float off.
Exactly. But he still has the ugly ripped pants.
Dan, control your podcast.
So, Adam, while we've got you on here, there's a story that began unfolding on Facebook. I was first made aware of it.
Oh, yeah.
I believe via Facebook.
Well, I only made you aware of it.
That's
purposely
true.
Purposely reached out to you.
And then I passed it along, and Keith Curtis posted a bunch of misinformed opinions and whatnot. But I was wondering if you could tell us about how you are passing the tradition along to your children, and in fact, the little war that erupted in, was it in the bathroom?
Started in the bathroom, finished in the kitchen table, and there's silence.
that's your whole story.
Go on.
No, I was just,
I didn't ask for a geography lesson.
I was waiting for someone to insert a joke there.
Okay.
As soon as I've heard about this whole role-playing thing,
yeah,
I thought that would have been a whole lot cooler when I was a kid.
Okay.
I mean, it's cool now, but to have used dice to have decided battles among, because when you're a kid, a battle's usually decided by whoever swings the character the hardest through the air, and if one is left unbroken, that one wins.
At our house, it's whoever is left on the table.
Whichever character looks coolest.
For me, it was which character I liked the most, because I took too good care of my toys to smash them up or firecracker them.
You're just like Pat. Pat would like polish them and put them on a show.
No, I'm not a psycho as Pat. I just didn't want to break them. They were not polished, put on a shelf, organized. I did not have an aneurysm if somebody moved them out of alphabetical order or whatever.
We won't talk about the fact that I cut all the hair off of my Barbies, put them in the Barbie dream house, threw them in the elevator, and then would scream, "Disaster! Disaster!" and drop them.
Yeah, so I had a G.I. I had a G.I. Joe character that I wrapped firecrackers around, and after it went off, he was damaged enough that I had to dig a hole, and all the others had a funeral for the G.I. Joe figure out in the front yard.
Oh, that's nice. Wow. We would have, like, I'm showing my age, those disaster movies where, like, a hotel fire or the earthquake.
Well, had a brief resurgence in the 90s.
Okay,
so.
Let's go with that.
Okay.
So I would recreate this in the Barbie dream house. That elevator fell a lot.
Oh, I was a Godzilla fan, so I took the time to gather up cardboard boxes. And we even went to, like, the store and went around back to the dumpsters and grabbed cardboard boxes and made a cardboard box city out in the front yard.
Nice.
And I was walking through it as Godzilla crushing the city.
Awesome.
And then it started raining and they all got destroyed.
It strikes me, Beth, that you played with Barbies the way an older brother would play with his little sister's Barbies.
Yeah, kind of. Like,
put them all in an elevator, drop them down, and kill them all.
We would always play barbershop, and I would, like, wash their hair and then cut their hair. And a little known fact about Strawberry Shortcake, if you wash their hair, the hair stands straight up. I don't know what the chemical composition of it was, but it got wet. It would stand straight up, and then I'd try to put their little hats back on, and they'd pop off. So they would just cut that right off.
Oh.
It was a strange
child. So what were we talking
about?
All right, go on. So tell us about this battle.
Yeah, okay. So getting ready for work one morning, I see Eli, my older son, 5 years old, on the floor in the bathroom, and somehow his superheroes made it in there. Superman, Batman, Iron Man. They were all pitted against this dinosaur.
As they would be.
Yeah, of course. The dinosaur was clearly evil. And
had to go.
Wayne, DC Marvel crossover where they fight dinosaurs. Come on, you've got to know the year, if not the author.
I said plenty of DC Marvel crossovers, but I don't know of any where they fight dinosaurs.
Oh.
I can point to comics where Superman fights dinosaurs. I can point to comics where Batman fights robotic dinosaurs. Or I can point to comics where Iron Man fights dinosaurs. But I don't know of any where they all fight them together.
Clearly a failing.
He should copyright this story. I'm just saying.
This is his college fund.
Hey, I'm willing to go that far then. So it just struck me, like, this is a pretty interesting mashup. So I thought, surely I'll send this to Dan and see what he has to say about it.
How was the battle going? Because I had my interpretation of the photos. Because when I saw the photos, what I saw was you had a dinosaur who looked like, I don't know, a T-Rex or Velociraptor or something like that.
But it was T-Rex, very large.
Okay, but the toy is larger than any of the superhero toys.
Oh, yeah.
And when I saw it, Superman and Batman are both lying on the floor, and Iron Man seemed to be locked in combat with it. And so my interpretation, which is the accurate interpretation of this picture, was that Superman had already gotten his ass kicked. Batman was so unimpressed he was napping, and Iron Man was in a fight with a dinosaur, which he was likely going to win. Now, I am curious to hear, though, what the narrative was from Eli's perspective and see how accurate it was.
Well, see, at the time, Eli didn't really have a narrative. It was just, I've got one hand, I've got one superhero, one dinosaur, taking turns.
Okay.
Know? So at the time, there was no narrative, but that's what the motivation was for breaking out the dice and putting a little more order to
it. Oh, cool. You put dice to it, too?
Oh, yeah. So
that's awesome.
Dan had told me about this game, Toy Wars. As soon as I heard about role-playing, I thought, that's the way to play. That's, you know, let's go get my G.I. Joes and Transformers and let's do this. And so we took the same characters, put them back. This was like a rematch, right?
Grudge match, the sequel.
Yes, that's right. So I put them on the kitchen table, and I just asked him. I said, okay, how are we going to do this? What happens? Who's against who? And he kind of decided everything. And naturally, again, put the superheroes on one side, the dinosaur on the other. What was really interesting about it is immediately he wanted to put a scorecard together. So he drew lines, must have had 20 lines on this piece of paper, and he drew lines all the way across and had one team on one side, the other team on the other side, and he wanted to keep score.
I wonder if he got this from watching us play like Progressive Rummy or something.
That could
like.
Be, yeah. Yeah,
that's what he's.
I was just thinking his first character sheet,
his inspiration.
Wow, that should go in the baby book.
I would.
Is there space for that in the baby book? There should be.
Yeah,
there should be.
Just tear out his first words and put in his first character sheet. So what happened? So
it was interesting because the roles initially favored Dad, and I was the dinosaur. I was the bad guy.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
And
usually, so, Mom's the bad guy, but in this case,
no. Yeah. So,
it's that way at our house too.
At times we'll celebrate when I make a kid cry. It's a big accomplishment for me. Yeah, the roles were going my way at first, so I was taking bites out of the various superheroes. But I noticed right away Eli was protecting Superman. Superman was left standing every time. No matter what the dinosaur did, Superman could take it. Or no, I'm sorry. Initially, it was Batman. Superman ended up being the victor. So now we have a couple series of pictures here. We have the dinosaur just trouncing on everyone, roaring and having a jolly time. And then we have Superman picking up the dinosaur, tossing him into the ocean. And,
as it should be.
Yes. And then all three superheroes stopping and posing for a team photo right in the middle of it all.
Nice.
That's the cover.
Yes, absolutely. And then immediately after that, the dinosaur takes advantage of that opportunity and whips his tail around, knocking them all down.
Evil will always triumph because good is dumb.
Love that quote.
That's nice. Then we have a picture of the dinosaur taking a bite out of Iron Man, which, looking back, it's in a pretty inopportune place.
Oh, dear.
I don't know if he's exposed in that area or what, but I never noticed that.
There will be no iron children.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Infuriated, Superman flies through the air, hits the dinosaur on the lower jaw, and it's just a blur in this picture because he's flying so fast. And that was it. Knocked him out. Then we have another team photo of all the superheroes standing on top of the dead dinosaur.
Nice.
And then the dinosaur was stuffed and put in the Batcave, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, naturally, of course.
Of course. See, at our house, it would Thor's hammer, Captain America's shield, and Spider-Man would have made an appearance because my son is obviously a Marvel guy.
Yeah, my son crosses lines. He makes no
well, favorite. Actually, what happened was at Christmas, I guess it was this past year or the year before,
yeah.
My sister and your wife, Christina, suggested that, you know, hey, maybe you should see if Eli's interested in some superhero toys. So I did some research on what the ones were that could actually stand up to a kid playing with them, because a lot of them aren't put together very well, and bought a whole stack of them. And then after buying them, realized that some of them have a surprisingly disturbing appearance. And so I called the boss over and said, so Christina, which of these are acceptable? And out of that, we ended up with Superman, Batman, and Iron Man, because the Scarecrow was the one from Arkham Asylum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where he has the hypos, like a Freddy Krueger claw.
Yeah, none of the Arkham Asylum are made for kids.
The Red Skull was a post-Comics Code Red Skull. And so a bunch of these got vetoed out. And those were the three that we ended up with. Did he end up with any bad guys?
No.
I don't think he did. And so...
Hence the dinosaur.
Yeah, hence the dinosaur.
When you're a kid, anything big enough is a bad guy for superheroes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so here's my question, though. Are you going to go on to get him Toy Wars 2 or teach him Toy Wars 2?
Oh, yeah. So I told him about sending you the photo and about the game, and he was excited.
Yeah.
He's, let's do it.
You know, I got to say, Adam, I think this is a great thing because of the fact that not only are you passing on geekiness to another generation, but if you look at what you did, you guys had a bonding opportunity. The best way to bond is to play.
Teaching him basic math.
You taught him basic math.
And creativity.
You taught him creativity. You let him kind of dictate the story. You threw elements at him that he had to respond to. So he didn't have complete control of the world, but nonetheless, he had an opportunity to express himself, to build narrative. You know, there's a lot of skills that a role-playing game teaches. And we did an entire episode on children and role-playing games. And I collected a list of recommended titles for kids. And I got these from people listening to the show, from professionals in the industry. But these were all games that were meant for kids that are somewhere in the, let's say, 3 to 8 range. And they teach a lot of great skills. And I think it is really unfortunate that the first game a lot of people experience is traditionally D&D. And I'm not saying that as a dig against D&D, but because of the fact that I think there are so many wonderful social, mathematical, imaginative, lingual, whatever skills that are taught by a role-playing game that children could benefit from prior to being old enough to really being able to get D&D.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm glad that games like, I mean, Toy Wars is not exactly a role-playing game. It's more of a battle game. But that's not to say you can't add story to it. You can't not ask for a story. It's not like someone's going to stop you.
Well, and also, you don't even really need a kit. I mean, you guys just grabbed some dice and did it.
Yeah.
That's such a fantastic idea. I'm Duncan, every time people come over, he begs and begs to come downstairs, see the table. When we were doing battle tech, I want to have a big robot. Just wasn't quite old enough, but I think he's old enough for this. So,
I say, BattleTech, he's probably a decade under 4.
Yeah,
but BattleTech is a really complicated game.
He wants that big robot so bad he can taste it.
There are big robot games that are designed for rules light.
BattleTech just is not one of them. BattleTech is one of those ones where
heck, I don't understand all the rules to BattleTech, and I'm much older than him.
It has a rule book too. Well, series of rule books that would threaten hero system.
You know, one lesson that Eli learned from this, I'm really glad we did this because I didn't realize it until just now, but thinking back, he learned to lose. At first, you know, the dinosaur was chomping up on everybody, taking pieces out of Superman and Batman, and he just kind of had to have fun with it.
And he had to learn to cope with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's huge.
He didn't throw a fit. You know, at first he was like, wait a minute. The good guys are supposed to win. You could tell there was this moment where he was trying to decide how to deal with it, and he just rolled with it and had fun. And
that's a huge thing.
Of course, the good guys won.
Of course. That's a huge thing, though. You have to teach them to fail when the stakes are small so that if they fail when the stakes are big, they don't just collapse like a house of cards.
Yeah.
Good parenting.
Oh, thank you.
Well, he's following proudly in the tradition of the Roper household where, Pat, he refuses to let your kids win, and if they do win, he'll demand rematches until he has ground them under the heels of his boot.
No, that was Chris.
No, that was Pat. He even admitted to this. This is his telling of the story.
Well, we had a discussion about how Daddy was an example of a bad winner.
Yeah, because there was an episode where we talked about how World of Warcraft was offline or something like that. So Pat went down to play, I think it was Uno. And he lost the first game, so he had to play like 8 more and win all of them before he was satisfied.
Yes, and he was trash-talking my 5-year-old. So I love you, baby.
He thinks it's very important for kids to learn to lose.
That's right.
Yeah. Especially if he's the one benefiting.
Yes. We've taught Duncan, if you lose, you say, good game. You don't cry, you don't fuss, you don't kick.
Why haven't you taught Pat that yet?
Yeah,
exactly. He's unteachable.
Pat's catch a Capricorn. Early, that's the lesson.
That's a Capricorn. Right. He is immutable. You take him or leave him. All right, let's talk about something else here. The reason that we have kind of an unusual ensemble here on the podcast today.
I take umbrage at unusual.
Would it be me or you, Beth?
I don't know.
That's pretty much everyone but Wayne, and Wayne's just weird in his own right. So,
fair enough.
The topic that we wanted to talk about is one that you three, I think, have a unique perspective to discuss, which is your first time out game mastering. Because I know there are a lot of people listening to this show that want to game master but don't know where to begin, or maybe intimidated by something, or they're just that passive player who maybe needs a swift kick in the pants to get started game mastering. And as much as I would love to pontificate about this topic, I don't think I can really do much more than moderate, for the simple reason that I have been gaming 24 years now, and I started as a game master. In fact, it was well into my gaming career before I ever played. I game mastered almost 100% of the time. My times out as a player on a consistent basis have really only been a recent thing since we've had this kind of new RPG group. So, I mean, I'm talking the past couple years. I mean, this has been since after Fear the Boot started and probably, Wayne, right before we brought you into the group. So, I mean, this is something we're just talking the past couple years that I've really started playing heavily. And so I simply don't remember what it was like to learn to game master any more than I can tell you what it was like to learn the English language. That was just kind of how I got into things. But in your guys' case, Adam, you've game mastered for the first time within the past year or less, to the best of my recollection.
Or much less, yeah.
Yeah, and you've only game mastered a couple times. Mm-hmm. Beth, you game mastered for your first time within the past month or two, if I'm not mistaken.
Last month.
And Wayne, while you've been at this a little bit longer, your first time game mastering has still been within the past, what, 2 years?
It was about 3 years ago at this point, but the first time in campaign was within the last year.
Okay, and
because there's a big difference for me between campaign and one-shot.
But you did also, though, start this as a full-grown adult with playing as your first experience.
Yeah.
So game mastering was the transition. So you guys gave me some talking points prior to the show, but mostly I'm going to turn this over to you guys because I want to hear from your standpoint what that transition was like, what the struggles you had were, what some of the mistakes you made were, and hopefully this will encourage people who are listening to the show to give game mastering a try, or if you're new to it, to maybe catch some things before they become problems. But I want to start with the most basic question that I can come up with, which is what motivated you to move from being a player to being a game master? Because a lot of people, they stay as a player for one of two reasons. They're too chicken to game master, or they're too comfortable as a player. They just don't have any need to GM. There's already somebody in the group that GMs. They don't need to do it. Why bother trying? What motivated you three to start GMing? Wayne, we'll go ahead and start with you since yours goes back the farthest.
For me, initially, it was I had stories I wanted to tell with players. I wanted that role because that role seemed like it would be fun initially. For doing one-shots and things like that, I also felt a little bit of, I'm on a podcast about role-playing. I should see both sides of the coin. I felt a little internal pressure there. And leading up to the campaign, it was just, I wanted to run a game. I wanted to run a story because I enjoy watching what the players are going to do with it. And for me, before ever running anything, I had this view in my mind of what it was like to GM. So I remember you were my first GM, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, you had everything worked out. You knew coming in everything we were going to do. You had anticipated everything we were doing because you made it look so seamless. And it wasn't until the first time that I'd run a one-shot that I realized how much you're actually winging it as you go. You know what's going on. You know the plots and things like that. But you never know what your players are going to do. And that was the big shell shock for me, is I had a completely wrong impression of GMing. I thought you had to be ready to, interpret anything that they were going to do, when in reality, you just have to be able to run with what they're doing.
So you had stories you wanted to tell. Was courage an issue for you? Because a lot of people that I've talked to through private messages or emails have said they want to game master, whether for their group or at a convention, but they're afraid to do it. And they're afraid to do it because either they're afraid of writing the story, they don't think they could write a good plot, they don't think they could do the performance art of running it well, maybe they're intimidated because they don't know the system that well. Was courage an issue for you?
Courage was a big issue, probably one of the biggest. The first time I ever did anything was a revolving GM game. So that helped some because I knew that the game had been set up, the characters had been set up. I was taking a starting point and rolling with that instead of having to start on my own.
Right.
And if it went bad, there's another GM that's ready to go the next week.
You could just surrender the torch.
Exactly. So that helped with that. When it came to campaign, there was a completely different kind of stress. Because if you're doing a one-shot or a con game, you have the stress of, okay, someone signed up, they're going to play your game. If I do a bad job and they don't enjoy the game because of it, I have ruined that slot. Versus a campaign, I think of as a longer term. Oh, well, I've just ruined 4 months or so of their time gaming.
You've ruined my 4 months.
Yeah, it was
out of my house.
It was a completely different type of pressure, but also it was a little bit easier.
Right.
Because in some ways, when you start the campaign, you gather everyone together, everyone's creating their characters, they're becoming invested in their characters, and you have things to work with. With a one-shot, if it's not an existing campaign or not existing characters, I have to present the characters, the story, the setting. There's more to do.
The beginning, middle, and end all have to occur in one setting.
Yes, and with a campaign, that doesn't have to happen.
Do you think there's a virtue then, maybe, in testing the waters with a short campaign where you sit down and say, okay, this is just going to be 1 or 2 months?
Yeah, definitely, because every time I've sat down to run, I've learned something, and right. I've gotten a little bit better with each time. My first few times out, my biggest mistakes, I can easily point to my biggest mistakes, was coming overprepared, having sheets after sheets after sheets of notes, and spending more time focusing on that than the players. And then I fell into the trap of feeling like I had to be managing the players at all times for them to have fun, forgetting that some of the most fun moments in roleplay is just characters interacting with each other while the GM sits back and lets it happen.
Right.
That was hard for me because I felt like it was my responsibility to create the fun.
Right.
And if they were creating the fun themselves, it must be because I'm failing. And I had to get over that pretty quickly, too.
As a game master, that's a sign you've had the best success. Now, if they have just completely run off with the campaign, depending on the type of game you're running, that may be a sign that things have gone awry. If you're running a sandbox game, it's a sign of success. But in any game, I think if you see the characters creating their own fun, latching on to things, the setting, latching on to each other's characters, that is a sign of wonderful success. Adam, let's move this over to you, because while yours is much more recent than Wayne's, I guess you'd be the next in the order of eldest GMs here. Yeah. So what about you? What motivated you to start GMing? Were there any issues of courage? What are the things you struggled with?
The element of story, I think, was always a motivation. But, you know, what's interesting is the two occasions that I've GM'd, it was more just out of circumstance. The first time, I was the only person that knew the system because I had played it at one of the Fear the Cons and wanted to tell other people about it. And because I was the only one that played in that game at the table, I ran it. And then the next time, it was a lone wolf situation. There was just me and another guy, and we just kind of flipped the coin, said who's going to run it. So, again, it was wasn't something that I really had to put myself out there. It just fell to me. Kind of got pushed into it, I guess.
I realize situation pushed you into it, but even that aside, was there some hesitance on your part? I guess maybe put this another way. Do you think you would have wanted to do it eventually if circumstance hadn't pushed you into it?
Yeah, absolutely. It just sounds like a lot of fun to almost play puppeteer with people's characters. You know?
Ouch. Like,
you could, you know, if somebody creates this really interesting character, as a GM, you get to kind of poke at them a little bit, see how they respond, and put them in this situation and just sort of set all the figurines up and then just let them kill each other. You know, just do interesting things with and see how people react.
Did you have any of those conceptions like I did about what it was like to be a GM before you'd done it?
I guess, Wayne, by the time you GM'd, you'd seen at least a couple Game Masters, but in Adam's case, outside of Fear the Con,
The very first time I had done anything was that revolving GM campaign.
Yeah.
All I had ever seen was you and Chad at that point.
Oh, because Chad was the one person before you.
Yep.
Because I missed most of the revolving GM campaign because of things going on in my
Which was why we
life.
Were running that one,
right,
so we could give you a break.
But Adam, in your case, I know you had played some games at Fear the Con. I think you were in a Chris Hussey game. Mm-hmm. You were in the game run by John, not the John on our show, but the everybody, what is it, everybody's John?
Everyone's John
game. That is a good question. Since you really, as at least at the campaign level, had only had me as a game master, and you'd seen these kind of other glimpses of other styles, and definitely these other guys run very different styles of games than I do. Did you have any preconceived notions of game mastering?
I think you'd given me a pretty good introduction to it. Honestly, from listening to the podcast, there was a period of my life where I knew way more about role-playing games than I had learned by experience just because I listened to the podcast. So I kind of got a feel for the story element, and I've heard you guys talk about, well, Dan prepares and Chad just shows up. And
yep, he's a listener.
Yep.
So I kind of knew there was different ways to approach it.
You could say that.
I guess that if I had any preconceived notions, it's that I had to have some sort of a plan. And the more, you know, I hear about the way Chad games, it's really interesting to me because just the idea that everything just kind of happens. And I know it's there's more to it than that, but just this free-form idea. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's one thing that's been very interesting. My style really is a blend of Dan and Chad, because they've been the two people that have GM'd for me the most. I took something from each of them and kind of blended it. It's like they're the, I don't even want to say the extreme end of the spectrum, but I'm right in the middle trying to balance what I get from each one of them.
Did you think it was going to be that way from the start, or did you go into it thinking, I'm going to do this more like Dan, or I'm going to do this more like Chad?
I figured I was more of a Dan-style GM, and I realized that preparing, that's the kind of game I want to run, but I enjoy more tilting a little more on the Chad side. But I want to be right about in the middle. I want I want both.
Have you just trademarked these terms yet, by the way?
No.
Dan-style,
well, but here's the thing, and I think I can say this fairly objectively. Chad does definitely represent one far extreme. Chad is happy showing up with absolutely nothing. I mean, hell, he could just leave a voicemail saying, you guys come up with a scenario, run the game, and tell me how it went, and he'd count that as game mastering.
You know, I have his ability to do that sometimes.
You know, and I am making fun of him, but I'm not genuinely picking on him, because don't get me wrong, Chad has run some great games and told some great stories. I don't think I represent the far opposite extreme, because while I do use a lot of notes and I do have a lot of ideas about the narrative, so I am certainly off on that side. I have gamed with people who are much farther to that extreme than I am, where they show up with a binder of stuff and it's very railroaded and it's all but scripted. I mean, effectively,
I completely agree with you. I was just trying not to call Chad extreme without calling you extreme too. I was trying to be nice about it here.
Well, stop that right now.
So that other extreme is out there. You just don't allow them on the podcast.
No, that other extreme just might be Chris. I'm not sure.
See, I fall kind of into the Chad camp, because I had a definite idea of where I wanted to go. It was in my head, but I didn't have any notes.
Let's talk about your experience now. So your first experience as a game master was now what? I mean, a month ago
about
or
a month
less?
Ago.
And your first game that you ran was a really unusual one to start off on, which is Inspectors.
Yeah.
And for anyone who's not familiar with Inspectors, the Game Master almost doesn't do anything.
Yeah, they kept not going where I wanted them
to go.
In
fact, the Game Master is kind of an impediment. The game is structured such that at every turn, you let the players dictate everything.
It's kind of a baptism by fire.
Well, is it? I mean,
yeah,
it almost strikes me as reverse.
It isn't, because I had a story I wanted to tell, and they kept meandering, and I'm like, okay, how do I let them have the control, but still kind of push them where I want them to be?
To give an example, she came with this fully developed story, and Chad rolls a six. And she's like, okay, here's what you... He's like, no, it's a six. Here's what I found.
I was like, ah!
So it sounds like a game designed to discourage you from ever wanting to GM.
Well, it was called You Have to Be on Your Toes. So whatever they came up with, I had to roll with it, which I didn't know if I could do at all. You guys didn't throw me that many curves, so I was okay. That was always my greatest fear, that I would have my nice, pretty story, and here's where I wanted to go, and y'all would go, oh, well, we're going to go over here, and it'd be like, game over.
I'm not saying it's ghosts, but it's
ghosts now.
I think I ran the same night after you ran it, and it is a different kind of game to run, because I ran one session of Inspectors as well, and
right. It
is very different. When you're used to being...
In control.
Yeah, when you're used to having some level of control as a GM, and they throw you something, you're like, how am I going to tie that back?
Crap, I have to redo my whole plot.
Woo-hoo! It's one thing when the players do something you don't expect. It's another when they say, oh, that guy I was just talking to was a ghost.
And you're like, no, he was... Oh.
Yeah, it's very odd when your whole setting changes out from under you.
So I see what you're saying in that it was probably like easier in some ways, but in some ways it was a lot harder because I had to give up that control, but still
I guess that's an expectations thing, because when you walk into Inspectors, I guess the best and worst thing is that at any given moment, it's the player's problem, not yours. And so if you walk in with that perspective, you can say, well, I don't even want to figure out what happened. You tell me. But on the flip side, if you come in more with kind of my approach, if I have a narrative I want to tell, and I'm not going to get as much enjoyment out of the game if I don't get to tell a narrative, then I think Inspectors would be a very frustrating game for me. I don't think it's a good game for me to run. I might enjoy playing it, but I don't think it'd be a good game for me to run.
Yeah, we were all talking after that, and you came with a very well-presented story that fit together very well, even though we ran it off the rails for you. And it's,
you didn't go that far.
Afterwards, we were all talking. It's like, we would love to see you run something that's more of a traditional role-playing game, because you did a good job telling the story. You did a good job preparing for it. She had her laptop up with a couple of websites looking up historical information about the sites that we were going to, all ready to go. And it's like, all of that works great with a traditional game, just not well with what we were doing.
But I have to say, I am trepidatious about running anything longer.
Why?
Well, story is not a problem. Okay. I could probably come up with something. However, because one of the things you threw out was like an alternative history type thing. There's a lot there. And I kind of did a postmortem with my first GM, who is awesome. I told him I was completely picking his brain if I do this. And one of the things that he said was the biggest rookie mistake people can do is shoehorning the players into a story or into a setting or into a game. Coming in and saying, we're doing this and y'all are liking it. Make your characters go. So while alternative history would be interesting to me, there's a lot of history in the world. So what I need to do is sit down with you guys and see what's interesting to you. Where do you want to go?
Well, and is alternative history something that you would want to do? Because it strikes me that one of the things that could be intimidating about alternate history is you have to know the actual history so well to deviate from it.
Well,
she's a big history.
Okay, that's a fair point.
If we go to the right places, if we go to the War of the Roses, I'm good. But see, that being said, I wouldn't want to just walk in and say, hey, guys, we're all playing War of the Roses. Pick your faction. Go. And everybody's like, what? I mean, that would be completely unfun for everybody. I don't know. And another thing that I am trepidatious about is the mechanic. That is probably my weakest point because I have Pat.
Well, and that's
as a player, Pat is my rules encyclopedia. If I don't know something, I make him look it up.
That's the reason why the very first game I ever ran was the Fear the Con game, because I knew that nobody else at the table could possibly know Skies of Glass better than me, because it wasn't published, and I was the only one at the table who had played under the newest rules that Dan had.
Yeah, I don't have that luxury with you guys. You guys all know rules better than I do.
It was the same thing with our Dresden campaign.
Oh, there you go.
With our Dresden campaign, none of us knew the rules.
Up your own game, or go find some tiny little niche game. That's a lot of work.
See, I would say the biggest barrier to GMing for me, laziness. So now you're going to tell me that I have to come up with an entire rule set, too?
Well, here's what I would say. I think there's a couple ways around that. One, assuming laziness isn't the issue, but you're intimidated by the rules, because another thing I've heard a lot of people say is, I'm afraid to run this game because everybody else at the table knows it better than I do.
I had the misconception of I needed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the system. You need to understand the system. I don't personally think it works if you hand the system over to someone else.
I agree.
You have to understand the system at least.
I absolutely agree.
And I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
Well, here's the thing, though. I think, as Wayne said, it is a very bad idea to basically get lazy, write it off, and split the GMing job. Well, I'm going to tell the story. I don't know the rules. I don't care to know the rules. Somebody else just tell me what we need to roll. That always ends disastrously. I have never seen that go well. But I do think there are a couple other options. One, if you're not lazy, and that's not the issue, write or pick up a brand new rule system. Get something nobody's familiar with. So even if all you know is 20% of it, you still know more than anybody else does. The second option, I would say, is that there are many rule systems out there you can learn very quickly. Stuart Robertson's Weird West. It is a one-page role-playing game. You can learn that, okay?
I can learn that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I have it sitting here somewhere. I don't want to make a lot of background noise by digging it up. But the point being that it's something that you could learn in no time and know that game just as well as anybody else in the world. The third thing I would say is, while I think it is a mistake to wash your hands and delineate the two roles, I have seen it work perfectly fine where the game master sits down and says, you know what, I want to run this game. I know a little bit about the rules, but I don't know them very well. But as the campaign goes on, I'm going to give myself a homework assignment where each week I'm going to read a little more, understand a little bit more of the rule. And by the time you get a little bit into the campaign, now you have a proficient knowledge, maybe not an expert knowledge, but a proficient knowledge of the role-playing game to where you can balance combat encounters, figure out target numbers, determine how things are going to go. And along the way, you allow the people at the table to help you by saying, this is what you need to do. Hey, this encounter is not real well balanced. And assuming you have a group of people who are not manipulative douchebags.
That's key.
That is very key. I think that can work wonderfully. And if you've got a bunch of douchebags, if you can at least find one person you trust and say, I'm going to use you as my rules go-to person.
Even people that are very comfortable with systems occasionally have to do this. I mean, when it comes to Pathfinder, for example, you know, John and I both have played a lot of Pathfinder. When we go to run it, you know, occasionally we have looked at each other and said, hey, do you remember how this works? Because you can't know everything that's in a book that thick.
That's true. Like I said, story is my thing. I'm sort of following the Chad side of the spectrum on this. So, but it's perfect because I have my engineer husband who tells me what I need to roll to make what I want to happen.
Yeah, I just found it. Weird West.
Oh, look, it's an 8x10 piece of paper.
There it is. It's that's an 8x10 piece of paper that
folds up.
Folds up into a little...
It's pocket-sized.
A little pocketbook. So
how cute.
That's a game that I guarantee you even the laziest person can read within a matter of minutes.
That's me.
And you could run a game that way. You could have whatever story you want. And it's intentionally so rules light. He did a great job with it. I love the concept he's got in that game. And so, you know, you could run that pretty well. Adam, in your case, the games that you were running really didn't have any rules. Wayne, in your case, you went for a game where nobody at the table, quite frankly, could have told you you were wrong anyway.
Exactly.
Because the only person that knew any better than you was at a different table running a different game.
Yep, and that was in my thought process. Because if you remember, what I originally wanted to run was Mutants and Masterminds.
Yes.
And I didn't feel like I had a good enough grip. I was too busy worrying about the system to try to figure out the story at that point.
Yeah.
And when I looked at it, it's like, well, I don't know the system well enough. I'm going to be worrying about running something I don't understand as well as the GM aspect. And I just was not ready for that. When it came to running Skies of Glass, it was like half of that was taken off my plate. Because like nobody's going to know this. There's no way they can.
You can totally make things up and no one would know.
Exactly. And that's I knew that in my mind. It's like if I run across something and I don't know the rule for it, and I make it up on the spot, they don't know that I didn't know the rule and I had to make it up on the spot.
So let's talk expectations versus reality. When you guys came into this with the notion of how game mastering was going to go, and then the characters and dice actually hit the table, what surprised you? What was different, better or worse?
I knew that it wasn't going to be easy, but I don't know that I realized how easy it that the GMs that I had played with in the past made it look. That's a lot of balls to keep in the air. And there's no downtime. Like when you're,
what do you mean by that exactly?
You got to keep everyone engaged. You got to keep the story moving forward, but not railroad people. Because that was the struggle that I had internally was I got something I want to say, but I don't want to start just driving the plot wagon over everybody's back. But you have to keep them engaged. You have to keep the mechanic. You have to settle disputes. You have to, I mean, it's just, it's a lot to keep going. And when you're playing, if somebody else, like if, you know, you and Chad or you and Pat are doing something over here and I've got time to sort of, oh, what's going on upstairs? I can look at my phone. Yeah, you don't get any of that downtime. It you're is a, on all the time.
That's very much the case. I mean, when I looked at it before as a player, I was far more passive. You're jumping into situations where you see a chance and you're role playing it out. But it is a lot more passive. You have that chance where if you want, you can sit back. You can get out of it for a second. As a GM, I always feel like the spotlight is always on me. You're always juggling what's going on, or you have to pay attention to everything that's going on, which I try to do as a player. But if I miss something that two other players say, it's not as big of a deal.
Yeah. Well, and then two, every once in a while, things would kind of come to a lull and like everybody's head would swivel toward me and I'd be like that moment of panic. I got to do something now.
Somebody created diversion.
Yeah. Look over there. And then you run.
No, it is a little intimidating, I think, to have to remember who has said what characters I've introduced, what plot points I've completely diverted from that I can't go back to 3 weeks from now when I don't remember we did any of this.
Yes.
I think that's why it's been really good for me to do just, I mean, I'm in GM in kindergarten. I've done no rules, one shot, sit down, have fun. Done, move on. It would be nice to take the next step, get something a little more complicated, but for now, this has worked.
One other thing that I've noticed that I never even thought about before was when you have a player that misses a week, or you have players that come in, players that leave, afterwards you're left trying to remember, was this player here the week when this happened? So as you're presenting things, one player may not have the full picture that the other players and characters do. And it kind of throws you if you have a lot of people that are either missed, coming in or out. You remember what was said, you can remember all of that, but you never know who heard it. And I mean, in our group, we've also got occasionally someone will have to run upstairs. We're in a house with a couple of kids. So you'll have to remember, was Pat downstairs when that happened? let's be realistic, was Beth downstairs when that happened, or was she upstairs? That's another thing you have to keep track of that as a player, you never even think about.
Yeah, you don't pay attention.
Who was at the table when the reveals happened?
Are there some of those things that you think, as a player, talking about here, and you think, oh my goodness, you'd have to keep track of this and that. Are there some of those things that as you've GM'd more, that you realize, you know what, you really don't have to keep track of all that. It kind of works itself out, or the players can kind of pick up some of these things.
I think it depends on your game mastering style. For example, in my case, what I will do is my plot outlines tend to have all the major facts bulleted out. So if this guy had a particular name, I can refer back to that sheet and he will always have that name. If it turns out that the king is secretly working for the evil wizard, I have that note there, so I'll keep it consistent from game to game. And then as the players impact the world, I'll make those notes. Like, okay, Wayne shot and killed the so-and-so, and so just I'll kind of make a note there.
Strike through.
That's what I found. Now, certainly, there is a lot that could go wrong, but one of the things that I think has really helped us as a group with that, and we seem to do this across all game masters, is we do the pre-game review, where we go back and basically say, okay, what happened in the prior games? And it helps you like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. I forgot they did that. I forgot they had this contingency plan. I forgot they hid this bomb, whatever the case is. And it helps you kind of fill in some of the blanks you may have forgotten about.
Yeah, I'm very much like Dan in that regards of my notes have the major plot points. I have sheets and sheets. Well, in my case, I was using a tiny little book, but if I had a full size, I would have a whole sheet of nothing but names. The consistency of names is very important to me because it's not for everyone that I've played under, and it bugs me. It bugs me a lot when you meet the same character and it has two different names. Kills immersion.
Or never gets a name at all.
Yeah. Well, and that's one thing is what I've noticed is I have more notes during the course of a game than what I brought to the game for that game. Making notes of what happened during it. If a new NPC is introduced that I didn't have planned, I'm writing down the name of that NPC and basic information about him. I also have a cheat sheet of myself for here are 10 plot points that I would like to throw into the game at some point in the campaign. And then if there's a lull, Dan always talks about blow something up. I already have my blown up things ready to go.
Oh, that's a good idea.
To give credit where credit is due, that's a Chad euphemism, but I think he's right. Is it does help, I think, to have a series of notes. And I do the same thing. The Chad certainly coined the phrase. I have a similar practice where I will have a bunch of kind of bulleted out plot points, some of which fit into the sequence of things, some of which are completely non sequitur. But it's like if things get going too slow, here's something I can have happen to get everyone back on task, to weird everyone out, to get their attention.
And those are my things that I'd kind of like to happen at some point in the campaign. Yeah. When it happens, doesn't matter, but it's good if the group's spending too much time just trying to figure out what's going on, or if the group looks like they're getting bored.
They get bored, they looked at you. You don't have to have a moment of panic, because you look down at your sheet and say, okay, needed to work these gangbangers in somewhere. Here's where it's going to happen. And you've got something already in there. I want to ask you guys two questions here, kind of as we close this out. The first question is, how has game mastering for your first times changed you as a player? Beth, we'll start with you.
I knew it would not be easy, but I did not realize how difficult it would be. So now, on the other side of the table, when someone is running a game and they just seem to be ruminating or sitting, I realize they're not just chilling. There were a lot of wheels turning.
Yep.
A lot of wheels turning. And I think I knew that, but now I know that, if that makes any sense.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. Generally speaking, some of the people who make the best diners are people who are former waiters and waitresses because they understand what goes into it. So I think that makes perfect sense. Waynard?
One of the big things for me was that occasionally before having run something, I would get frustrated if the group couldn't seem to figure out a major plot point. You know, as players, we couldn't figure it all out. And at that time, I would just keep thinking, well, the GM needs to give us something here. After having run stuff, I realized that the GM probably has given us quite a bit and we didn't bite on what was given, or maybe we're focusing on the wrong thing. And instead of having that, looking to the GM to give me the, you know, basically roll up the plot wheelbarrow, I start looking at what we've already done and I try to approach it more you know, as a player, what can I do to try to get us back on track instead of just expecting the GM to right the train? Because chances are the GM's already tried and the group probably didn't do something they should have.
That was hugely difficult for me because you guys missed a couple of clues and I wanted to go, oh, go back, go back.
I'll give you a little thought exercise on that in a second. But Adam, I want to hear your answer to this. And then I'm going to give you guys a little thought exercise.
It's similar to what Wayne said. When a GM throws something out at you and you've been in that chair, you're just desperately waiting to, please run with this. Please do something with this. Take it and make it your own. Really interact with this character or this plot point.
Don't you realize how important it is?
Right. Exactly.
This is my baby. Please.
This is really cool. Would you just bite?
Yes, yes. And when they just walk on by, oh, yeah, that is kind of an interesting looking dwarf riding the elephant, you know, with the pink wand and
a key around his neck.
We're just going to leave it alone and move on. I mean, it does make you, I think, when you get back in the player's seat and you say, okay, there's probably something to that. Let's explore it. Let's have fun with it.
As a game master, I think one of the things that you need to do is be prepared to represent information. That if the party doesn't bite at it here, if that information is critical to the plot, have another way that they can get the same information. There's another place it might pop up. They might re-encounter the same person. I've certainly had that frustration even recently. I mean, the one Stone Keep game we ran, and I don't know if we're going to resurrect that or not, but the one game we ran, I gave like three slow ball pitches of get the party to the town gate. And finally, I had to stop and say, will somebody please take the party to the damn town gate? And finally, John's like, okay, I'm going to grab all the other player characters and we're going to the town gate. And so you certainly have to be prepared to kind of move things around a little bit because you don't know what people are going to latch on to. Because one, they're playing in character and maybe something isn't interesting to their character. And two, they're not in your head. They don't understand what's significant. The thought exercise is going to give you is this is a little puzzle. If you know the answer, don't shout it out. Well, you on the mics, you guys at home, I don't care what you do. But
shout.
There's
a million people shouting at their iPads.
Here's a little puzzle. You have a room. And in this room is three light switches. There is a door that leads into another room where there are three light bulbs. Now, you may stay in the first room as long as you want, but the moment you cross over to the second room, you are stuck there. You cannot see room A from room B, so standing in the doorway is not an option, okay? And there's no cheap answers to this. You can't hold the door open. You can't drill holes in the wall.
There are no windows.
There's no windows. So just with the information I provided...
Can you look under the door?
No. With the information I provided, how do you tell which light switch corresponds to which light bulb?
I hate these.
I know the answer, so I'm letting other people.
So how do you tell which light switch corresponds to which light bulb?
I think I'd have to phone a friend there.
Well, see, here's the thing. And this is where I'm going to tie it back to role-playing games.
And he even foreshadowed this.
A lot of times, the players don't get what you're getting at because they're not looking at the problem in all of its possible angles. They see a crazy old woman. They write her off as a crazy old woman. The possibility that she's a diviner doesn't occur to you, okay? And they don't think kind of in the same terms that you are. Now, the answer to this riddle is the fact that most people will get fixated on one thing. Light bulbs produce light, okay? So if you turn on or off two switches, when you get to the next room, two lights are either on or off. You've not solved the puzzle. You may have connected one light switch to its light, but you've not connected all three. The answer outside of the box is that light bulbs don't just produce light. They produce heat. So what you do is you turn on two light switches, wait about 10 minutes, turn one off. When you go into the other room, the light bulbs are in three states, dark and cold, dark and hot, and lit. And now you know which bulb corresponded to which switch.
And you have burnt fingers.
But you got there because of the fact that you're thinking about lights in terms of something other than the fact that they produce light. They also produce heat. And it's the same thing when you're game mastering. Sometimes the way you present information, the players see it through a certain lens. They don't necessarily see it through the lens that you're trying to get them to see it through. You know, they don't understand its significance because of the fact that they're not interpreting the world the same as you.
That's why game recaps are so great, because they also let you know what the players got out of what you presented.
Oh, bingo. Yes, that's an important point. I didn't have that on my notes, but I'm absolutely glad you brought that up. Because, yes, a lot of times hearing the players regurgitate the information tells you, one, what they walked away with, and two, things they may have just grossly misunderstood. And sometimes it's like, well, that's in character. They misunderstood it and let it ride. Other times it's like, no. That's not even what I was describing.
I've even had a third option of they misunderstood it, but it sounded so good that I reworked what was going
it's
on.
It's now better than what I had.
Exactly. So I reworked what was going on from that point on.
So let's end this on a question I'm going to put around the table. And Adam, we'll start with you this time. If there's someone out there right now who is contemplating game mastering, but is afraid to do it, hesitant to do it, is about to do it, but hasn't done it yet, what's your advice to these people?
Don't hold anything back. Because if you go into it and you're a little bit intimidated and you're scared, it's not going to help you. Just take everything that's in your personality, all the things you like about gaming, all the things you like about movies and books, and just throw it in. Go for it. I mean, it's easy for me to say because everything I've done has been in the absolute easiest of circumstances. There's been no audience. There's been no rules to worry about, no canon to screw up. So maybe that's what you do. Maybe you just set yourself up for success to start out with. But yeah, I think it's figure out whatever it is that you like about gaming and then do that. Because if you're having fun with it, probably other people are going to have fun with it.
Wayne?
Try to relax and just roll with it. That's the big thing. If you try to be too prepared, you won't know what the players are going to do. Just try to be calm and relaxed, and the players will kind of get that feel from you. Remember that everyone around the table is there to have fun too. Too often, especially going into, you know, preparing for a con game, there's always the concern of, oh, I won't make this fun for them. If you've got a good group of people, if you're doing this for your home group and you know you've got a good group of people, they will help you make a good game session. They will help make it fun. It's not all on you.
They want it to be fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They don't want you to lose.
I think in most groups, there's going to be at least one person you can lean on for help, for advice, for insight. You could be in a group of dicks. If you're in a group of dicks, switch groups. It's really
that's
that simple.
That's a whole other issue.
You know, if you're in a group of dicks, I am perfectly okay with you saying, you know, I don't want a GM.
I think you'd even be better to say, look, this is my hobby time. I'm going to go do something else.
No, I'm going to give you a quote that I got from my first GM, and I believe I'm going to put it on a t-shirt. Sometimes you just have to say, I'm the GM, suck it.
I try to avoid that, but nonetheless, yeah, there are some situations where it's necessary. Beth, what's your advice?
Remember that you're running this for your friends. If you crash and burn, they're not going to pillory you. They'll most likely try to help you save it and then maybe give you some pointers after to make sure that you don't do it again. These are your friends. They will be supportive of you. Unless you're in the group of dicks, and that's a whole other issue.
Yeah, it's a different episode.
Yes.
Gaming with Dicks, which is going to be the intro music, one of us saying don't, and then it's going to be the outro music. It's going to be the shortest episode we've ever done.
And then Chris May is telling us gaming stories.
Score.
So, anyway, Adam and Beth, thank you guys very much for joining us for this episode.
Thank you for having me.
Wayne, you're regular, so.
We don't care.
You're still welcome.
It's your it's your responsibility to pursue this hobby. As for the rest of you guys, if you have never GM'd or you're prepping to do your first GMing, whatever, I hope this episode has been of some inspiration to you. If you're a veteran GM, pass this along to somebody in your group because, quite frankly, you probably need a break. And above and beyond all that, have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.